Guys, I pastor a church downtown Johnson City, tons of construction, right? The town is changing dramatically. City managers and such have gone to all the other little cities around the South that kind of have a cool hipster vibe, and they're basically saying, what can we do to make downtown Johnson City be awesome? And it's a pretty awesome place to live. Our church is in the epicenter of it. And so we have been in the, you have to really want to come to our church to worship. I mean, we needed like a drawbridge over a moat for about a month. Like just, everything is being done. And what's been fun for our church staff, and my kids are like, Dad, I swear, all you do is look out the window, drink coffee, and watch construction workers. And you send us pictures. But the reason we keep doing that is like, what are they doing? Didn't they already dig that hole? And they filled it in and dug it for some other contractor, putting some other line in? Like, what are they doing? There's got to be a big, big idea, right? Like, all the different steps in this process, there's got to be, tell me there's a big idea, or else just a bunch of guys playing in the dirt. I'll use the same concept of big idea. I've got two daughters that play college soccer for the same university. And when we go watch them play, they play different positions. It's a lot of fun as parents. But I watch what they're doing, and I play college soccer, I coach soccer, I refereed NCAA soccer, and so it's kind of a love for me. But I sit there, I'm like, what's the big idea? Like, what is their coach asking them to do? It's not the same thing they did the last match. So then as a father, I'm thinking, gosh, I sure hope my daughter's playing her part. There's definitely a tactical plan here. What's the big idea? That's what this instruction is really going to hit on, is a principle called the melodic line. So I'm going to use that same big idea thought, and we're going to use music to introduce it. Here's the drawing that we will use. I got a buddy I'm meeting with tonight who is like the executive director of the Boston Symphony, so maybe he'd be proud of my drawing here. It's music notes, right? Eighth notes, I guess. 16th notes. I meant to do this there. Now it's an eighth note, right? Is that right? Okay. Music. There's our drawing. The big idea of a song is encapsulated how? With the melody, right? The melodic line of a song. It's the big idea, and what a song does is when a big idea comes to us, it gets stuck in our head. And does what a song does. It just, even as Eric was saying, it's sticky. Something sticky. Songs stick. So I want to do a little illustration with you. I'll pull out my phone here. I'm going to read you a line of a song. I don't think you'll know this. If you know it, you're not allowed to speak. I'm going to read you a line of a song. I want you to tell me what you think the line is about. And then I want you to just take a stab, but we'll talk about it. What do you think the whole song's about? Are you ready for this? When she walks on the street, you can hear the strings. Open question. What do you think the line's about? What do you think of? And what do you think the whole song's about? You're all trying to figure out what song it is and if you know it, but that, what do you think? What's, when she walks on the street, you can hear the strings. What do you picture? Go ahead, let's.
He's into a girl.
There's a girl. Strings, like what kind of strings? Like, you say a puppet? Oh, I haven't heard that. Good. Maybe. Could be. Oh, so you're thinking like string music. Yeah, beautiful girl walking down the street and the music's in the background. You know, maybe imagine a girl. She's so beautiful. It's all black and white in front of her, and as soon as she walks by, everything turns to color. Okay. Is that what the song's about? Let me read to you some lyrics from this song, and then I'll make the connection to our principle. Read some of the song. When she walks on the street, you can hear the strings. Grace finds goodness in everything. Grace, it's the name of a girl. It's also a thought that changed the world. Grace, she's got the walk, not on a ramp or on chalk. She's got the time to talk. She travels outside of karma. She travels outside of karma. When she goes to work, you can hear the strings. Grace finds beauty in everything. Grace makes beauty out of ugly things. Anybody know what song? What artist did that song?
U2.
It's U2. It's U2's song, Grace. What's the song about? There's strings involved. Is it about a girl? No. It's about grace that's different than karma, they sing. Grace that makes beauty out of ugly things. And the girl is referenced in a few lines in the song to picture the beautiful transforming reality of grace. So here's the connection. Would we ever pretend to know what a line of a song is about if we don't know what the song is about? The big idea of the song? Can we understand what a line is about without understanding the big idea of the song? And to connect it to the theme of melody in that song, if you know it, it's a beautiful song, but the melody that keeps singing about grace as a reality that makes beauty out of ugly things, I can hear the melody in my head because the melody is the rehearsed, repetitive, in this case, very beautiful sound that fits the lyrics that are repeated over and over. Here's the principle. Books of the Bible have a sustained message, a big idea that's similar to the unique melody of a song. It's waiting to be heard, and every passage will in some way be related directly or indirectly to this melody. So it's the unique and sustained message of a book. And as listening preachers, our task is to listen well enough and listen long enough to hear it and to try to capture it in a concise statement, a single short sentence that we would say is the melodic line, the big idea of the song of the book that we're studying. And then once we know what that line is, the melodic line, we'll be better equipped to understand what each passage in that book is about. So this is the principle of the melodic line. Every book has a coherent and sustained message. It's waiting to be heard. And is the job of a preacher, by God's help and with lots of prep study, to hear it, ideally before preaching from a text. I never forget when I first started going to the Wheaton workshops, Kent Hughes was talking about preaching Philippians, I think. And he was like, I've read Philippians 40 times in the month before I started working on mapping the series. Okay. I wonder what he would say about the book of Isaiah. Right? So how do we discover the melodic line? If the question is, what is the message of the book about? We need to be doing some things. What do you think? What are some strategies? And we'll hit this kind of just in popcorn before we start digging into them. What do you think? How do we do this? Top and tail, which we'll explore in a second. Can you give a definition of that? What is that? That's Simeon Trust speak. Good. Great. We'll look at some examples in a second. Let's just keep popcorning. What are some other strategies? Top and tail.
Key verse is what the book's about.
So some form of purpose statement, key verse. Okay, good. Which we'll talk about. I think there's a unique way in which prophetic literature needs to kind of utilize that tool that might be very different than an epistle, for example. What else?
Repeated words.
How do you see repeated words? By repeated reading, right? Yeah. There you go. Repeated reading. Good. Okay, so anybody else want to say something that hasn't been said? Because we're going to do each of these in a little bit. Good stuff. What I want to say before we jump into doing this in some prophetic literature, and then we'll do it in Isaiah, is to emphasize there's huge payoff in our preaching to slow down and do this. Huge. This is not just an academic exercise. Meaning's at stake. Not just the meaning of the whole book for the people to whom I'm leading, but also the meaning in the individual text I'm preaching as I realize how it fits into a bigger message. And so I hope we're going to see that. But that's the thing I want you to keep kind of in your mind and your heart. There's payoff to do this hard work. I find it to be one of the hardest parts of preaching, also one of the most enjoyable. Different pastors do it differently. But I know guys who've been around the Trust for a long time, they don't ever really reveal the melodic line. It's just always interwoven in the sermons as they're doing it. I tend to, if it makes sense, in the first sermon of a series, do a little bit of an introduction using top and tail to show what the melodic line is. It's going to always be holding us as we do this series, as we proceed. So there's different ways to use it. But what we're going to emphasize is using it in our study so that there's payoff when we're teaching each text. So, all right, let me start to enter some of these examples. Let's start with the strategy of top and tail. Okay? Top and tail. Some of the examples that we might typically use in a Simeon Trust workshop come from different text types and different parts of the Bible. So if you're in Romans 1, Romans 16, that might be an example you've seen us use in a workshop, right? You see the repetition of obedience of faith among the nations in the beginning and the end, and it's giving a sense to the parts in the middle. So when Paul talks about justification by faith, we've already got some guardrails set by the top and tail to understand where's he starting and where's he ending to help me not just preach individual justification, because he's into this reality of the nations having faith that justifies, right? So it's going to guide us in all we do. But let's talk about the prophets. Turn to Habakkuk chapter 1, because I think it's a little different often in the prophets than certainly in epistle. Turn to the prophet Habakkuk, okay? So I'm going to actually have you look at Habakkuk 1:1-4. In fact, I'd like to have somebody stand and read it in a second, and then I want to have somebody else stand and read chapter 3:16-19, okay? We'll just do this kind of quickly, but here's what I want you to do is, as two brothers stand and read, do you hear anything repeated or do you hear anything contrasted? We're just going to compare the beginning of this prophetic work to the end of the prophetic work, and then let's just, as a group, say, hey, this is what I notice. Parallels, contrasts, whatever it is, okay? Two guys. There's one, hold on, who's going to read the end? Okay, do top and do tail. So compare. What do you hear? I mean, what do you see that's going on? Where does it start? Where does it end? I mean, not to say words, even just the tone. What do you hear that's different? Okay, so you have the prophet in an accusatory way saying, God, why are you making me look at this and you don't seem to care? And then at the end, he's trusting, right? Distrust, doubt, confusion starts the book. Trust, and in fact, notice at the beginning, Habakkuk's asking questions, peppering God with questions. What is said that Jamie just read in the latter half of verse 16? I'll wait, how? Quietly. I start out asking you questions, and I'm going to now wait quietly. At the beginning, what is he saying is lacking? What's not there? Justice. At the end, what's he saying? Even if I don't see the resolution I long for, I'm going to rejoice because I trust your justice. Now, in between, there's a lot we would look at as to God saying, I'm going to show you something that you wouldn't believe of how I'm going to bring righteousness, right? So that's in the middle. So one of the things I want to show you in this reading is a lot of times in the prophets, what we have in the top and tail is a trajectory. The tone goes from A to be, right? We see that. Now, sometimes in the top and tail, there's themes repeated. So I won't have you turn here, but let's just rehearse this quickly. If you know the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel 1 and 2, think about the glorious vision that Ezekiel has of God on his throne, and he falls on his face, right? You have the vision of glory. And then the last 8 chapters of the book of Ezekiel, what is it all about? A vision of the glory of God in his temple. In fact, the very last verse in 48, verse 35 of Ezekiel, it just ends with, and the Lord is there. Right? So you look at Ezekiel and you say, top and tail. Vision of glory. Vision of glory. Fleshed out all the more. Right? So that wouldn't be as much a trajectory. It's just an expansion of it. But that's top and tail. Okay, and we're going to look at top and tail in Isaiah in length here in a bit. Let's go to another example. What do you think a purpose statement would be in the prophets? Think about do we find purpose statements in the prophets like we do in 1 John or in certain letters? An epistle, I'm writing this so that, what might stand as a purpose statement in a prophetic piece of literature. Commissioning. I was hoping when you would say that. Yeah. Yeah, turn to Jeremiah. We'll look at Isaiah's in a second. But for time's sake, turn to Jeremiah chapter 1. I just want you to observe with me that in Jeremiah 1, verse 5, the word, well, 4 and 5, now the word of the Lord came to me saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations. All right? Now, with your partner, just do me a quick favor. Look at verse 6 through 8 and tell me what happens. Well, really 6 to 10. What do you see with regards to his commissioning for Jeremiah? Starts out, general, prophet to the nations. Yeah, but what? So look in verse 6 to 10 and just talk to your partner for a second. What is this commissioning really about? From 6 to 8, we got the general call. You're going to be a prophet to the nations. That's what Jeremiah is told. What do we see in 6 to 8? What gets fleshed out in his commission? What's he ultimately going to be doing? Specific place to say specific things. Okay, how about verse 9 and 10. What's he going to have to do? Specific. It gets real specific. Pluck up, break down, pluck up, and then what? Build and plant. Sounds a lot kind of like Isaiah, doesn't it? But there are particular things that we as the reader then can expect are going to be throughout the book of Jeremiah. You have the breaking down, the plucking up, and you have the replanting and the building up. That's your calling, Jeremiah, and that's probably a very helpful thing for us to see as the purpose of his prophetic ministry. Okay? All right, so we're going to look at that in Isaiah here in a moment from chapter 6, which we already did in a small group. Another thing that just want to make sure we're not lost on, but we're going to do it as an example here in a sec. You have top and tail, purpose statement. We said read. A lot of times there's themes that come out to us. You said repeated word, Jamie, but themes, these are going to come out. And so the best way for us to do it, I just want to walk through Isaiah with you. And just see if we can begin to formulate that concise melodic line that's real sticky that we would say can hold us in our preaching. So let's turn to the book of Isaiah and see if we can just play around, and not in like a sandbox or something, but actually just really dig in together. All right, so I want to start with the top and tail in Isaiah, and I'm going to do the best I can to kind of, let's split the room right down the middle, okay? So we're in Isaiah. What I'd like to have is on this side of the room, if you're over here, I want you and your partner to compare some passages in the top and tail. So 1, verse 2 and 3, and 65, verse 17 to 19, okay? That's. And then I also want this same side, so you'll do that, but then also do 1 verse 7 and 8 and compare or contrast it to 65 verse 19 to 22. Okay, so that's this side of the room. So you guys kind of have four things to look at in your setting. On this side of the room over here, I want you guys to look at 1, 21 to 23 and compare or contrast it to 66, 10 to 13. Also, look at 1, 12 to 15 and contrast it or compare it to 66, 21 to 23. Okay? Let me tell you where we're going with this so you don't just, you're not in the dark. We're going to look for things we see in the top and tail. Then we're going to say, hey, are there things in the top and tail that show up in Isaiah's commission, which we could say is like a purpose statement? And then we're going to say, hey, are the things we see in the top and tail in Isaiah's commission statement that are themes that surface through the whole book. And that's what we'll do over our course of our time together and see if we can get closer to saying, this is what the book's about. Gotcha? Okay, so take 2, 3 minutes, 4 minutes. Oh, which way did it show up? Okay, do it how it's written here. Sorry, I'm backwards. So, yes, you guys do that and you guys do that. Thank you, Brandon. It's my goal when I use this thing to confuse everybody. Actually, Isaiah would do it from this angle, I think. just kidding. It's a lot to do, but I think it can get us started. So let's start with this side, your first comparative group of texts. What do you see in 1, 21 to 23, and compare and contrast it with what you see in 66, 10 to 13? I won't be able to write it all down, but just shout it out. Let's share it. Okay. God's creation ends in joy. Okay. Rebellious is the first part, right? What else do you guys see? A lot of you worked on it. Any other words you want to make sure we emphasize from? Oh, you see that? Heaven and earth to new heavens and new earth. Okay? Rebellion to joy. Heaven and earth in 1 and 2 are doing what? They're witnesses against the rebellious children of God. And then the new heavens and new earth is the place of the enjoyment of the people of God. So I'm just going to write for right now that the heaven and earth component is huge. The transitional experience, the trajectory has totally changed for the people of God, right? Heaven and earth. God. I'm not writing anything else down. We're just going to keep talking. All right. Okay, now, first two texts over here. What do you guys see? Compare them. Contrast them. The text, that whatever I was assigned to you. Could you say it more succinctly? Please don't try. That was, wow. Yeah. Anybody else want to try to amplify that? The city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, yes. All right, so that's actually over here, right? Jerusalem. From whore to mother, okay? And this was from rebellion to joy, and this was the heaven and earth to the new heaven and earth, okay? We're seeing trajectory, aren't we? Let's go back to this side, your second set of texts. What did you see? Yes. Make sure I write it in the right place. So this is 1:7, yeah. Desolation to fruitful, right? How desolate is it? I mean, like the only thing that's producing anything is like a cucumber hut or something, right? Just mowed to the ground. Nothing is growing, right? Desolate to fruitful. Anything else you guys would amplify there? So you've got a devour component. Yeah, but you have foreigners devouring to God's people enjoying. Okay. God's people enjoying, okay. Let's go back to this side for the last set. What do you see? Compare, contrast that last bit, 12 to 15, with 66. Oh, total worship reversal. I'll just say that for the sake of space. Right? I mean, God wants to throw up when his people are worshiping him in 1, 2, true worship. Who's going to be doing the true worship in 66, that section? All flesh. Expansive worship. So let me try to just take all this and summarize. See the trajectory piece I was referencing earlier? Total trajectory change. We don't know exactly what we're going to do with it, but in the top you have, I'll try to say it all together. The heavens and earth are testifying against God's rebellious children for their vomitable false worship, resulting in devastation of the holy city. That's the top. And then the tail is the redeemed children of God from the nations among all flesh, worshiping God truly from the heavenly Jerusalem and a new heavens and new earth, and they're enjoying every bit of it. Major trajectory, top, tail. Okay, so that's one strategy. Now what do we do with that? So let's go further. Let's look at the purpose statement. Turn to chapter 6. For time's sake, instead of going, we already have spent some time in it, but look in just 9 to 13, do you see what themes come up that might be connected? That's the key question for time's sake now. Because if you're doing it on your own, you want to see a lot of the themes in the commission and say, well, gosh, this is telling us what's going to happen in the book. But is there things that we see in the top and tail that show up in the message that Isaiah is supposed to declare? I don't think we need to read it. We read it in our groups. But is there overlap of what we just looked at? Go ahead and shout it out if you see anything. Desolation. Other things. Desolation is linked to judgment. And in a second, I'm going to ask you for broader themes. But is that the biggest one that stands out to you that was prominent in the top and tail? Okay, where do you see recreation?
New creation.
New creation in 6. Is there a hint of new creation in 6? I think you're onto something, Andrew. Holy seeds at stump. There's going to be something new that's in Isaiah's message, right? So I'll just write that word for new creation. Good. All right, now pan out and don't worry about what we saw in the top and tail, the other themes that seem super prominent in this commissioning. They don't have to have been already referenced in the top and tail, but you know from your own study and your small groups and stuff, they're pretty big themes in the book. You see anything? Okay, stay in the message part, which is 9 to 13. Hard hearts, that's good. I like that you connect it to worship. Blindness, talk about something that's going to show up in the book. So we got some new themes introduced that if we're in our study, we're like, that wasn't in the top and tail. Blindness isn't in the top and tail. In the sense of an actual, word blind. Sight's not mentioned in the ones I showed you, at least. But we know that the trajectory from devastation to new heavens and new earth, what's the problem that we're presented in the commission? Hard hearts, blindness. How in the world is God going to move his people from here to here? That starts to present itself as we compare these two strategies. Okay, let's begin to trace a little bit out. Let's just trace desolation and judgment. Yeah, sure. I mean, I just use far away because that's really what's gone on is even in one, they're very far away from God himself through false worship, etc. He's going to be sending them away from himself. He's also going to be bringing a remnant back. We know that's going to be a theme through the book. So, yeah, that's what you're doing is just tracing in the message itself. Do I see things connected to even the top and tail? Then we say, well, now do we see some of these themes show up in the rest of the book? So let's just sink our teeth into desolation and judgment for a second. I think Isaiah has been an enjoyable book for me personally to study, but when I got the email and said, hey, you want to go to Cambridge to do Isaiah? I'm like, that sounds like the dumbest idea you could ever have to send a East Tennessee pastor to Cambridge to talk about prophetic literature. But if you want, it was a privilege. But you know what I started doing? I started reading Isaiah in my pre-breakfast times for 2 months straight. I wish I understood it better by now because I just kept reading it. And in my little black moleskinny notebook there, I've just got every place I could find desolation. And it's just kind of like what I drew for you guys the other day. It's just everywhere, isn't it? And as I was talking to Kevin Walker, who just has become a friend through this process, he and I were like, just kind of noticed that Isaiah over and over, 34 and 35 are good examples. We could think of lots of places. Isaiah's ministry of preaching to the point of desolation is like God wants to use him to demolish his people, to mow them down to the ground, like we just saw in chapter 5, right? So he can replant the vineyard, so he can rebuild the city. It's just rehearsed over and over and over. It's in the top and tail. It's in his purpose statement. Why does God have to do it? Well, so I'm not going to show you all those texts. Just I think we've seen enough already a little bit. Because the blindness of his people, right? Isn't that what's going on? So it's Israel's problem. So turn to chapter 42. There's desolation because God's people have hard hearts and they're blind. Look in 42, 18 to 20. Can somebody stand up and read this? How bad is this problem that requires God to mow his people down, if you will? 42, 18 to 20. So Brandon helped us a lot in using this servant song in his last session, which I'm very thankful he did because we don't need to spend a ton of time in it except to see that the vocation was given to God's people. And they weren't able to fulfill their vocation because of their blindness. And so you just have this pervasiveness of the problem presented in the commission connected to the top of the book, which says the extent of the problem. But we still have a question then to say, how is God going to reverse the desolation and devastation and fix the problem? We see hints of that in the book. So let me show you some places. 32, 1 to 4. Can somebody stand and read that? 32, 1 to 4. A king's going to come. What's he going to do? A king's going to come. He's going to open eyes. He's going to open ears. Right? 42. Again, we just looked at it, but if you look at verse 6 and 7, 42, 6 and 7, the servant's going to come who will fulfill his vocation to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. I'm the Lord. Okay, so the solution is hinted at in the book of blindness going away, but we also know that what needs to happen in order to get to the tail, the trajectory, is God's got to do a work of rebuilding. we carry on. How is God going to do his work of rebuilding? Well, again, I'm imagining we do this in our study for a long period of time. Well, we begin to think of other themes or names of God in the book. What's the name of God that maybe you've heard us reference 25 times in the book? Holy One of Israel, through all the different sections. Who's going to be the one that addresses the blindness because he sends his servant, he sends his king to do that? Who's going to be the one that reverses the trajectory? The Holy One of Israel. So let's just track that. If we were saying we want to find another major theme, which would be God's sovereignty and his holiness, his being the one that would do this, let's go back to the top and tail. In chapter 1, verse 4, Holy One of Israel shows up. Let me read it to you. Chapter 1, verse 4. And then if somebody can read 60, verse 9. So I'll turn to 1, verse 4. Somebody, Dan, you want to turn there? 60, verse 9, so we can read them back to back. This is in the top. It's hinted at. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, offspring of evildoers, children who deal corruptly, they have forsaken the Lord. They've despised the Holy One of Israel. What does blindness look like? What's hardness of heart looks like? It looks like despising the holy God who would make you to be his people, who's going to be the one that brings desolation. Now, 60 verse 9. The Holy One of Israel is going to be the one that makes his people beautiful. The nations are going to bring the riches of worship to the God who does this change. And so we see the agent in the top and tail of being God himself, the Holy One, who's sovereignly going to make this happen, both at the heart level, but also at the restoration of the desolation that he's going to bring. Okay, now, I know I'm trying to track through this gargantuan book, but how does God do that in the book of Isaiah? How is God going to reverse the desolation? I drew it up on the board yesterday. We've got songs that Brandon talked to us about today in the middle section. There's the king he's going to send, right? Chapter 9, 11, four songs of the king. Then you have the servant, which we look at in 49, 50, 52, and then the conqueror at the end. God's going to do this through the individual he sends. But then if we're new to studying Isaiah, we say, well, is it three different people? The king, the servant, the conqueror, or is it one person described differently? And so if I were to fast forward through some of this, can I have somebody turn to 11, verse 2. Brett, why don't you do that? Can I have somebody read 42, verse 1? Okay, and then somebody turn to 61, 1. Okay, so we're looking at 11, verse 2, 42, 1, and 61, 1. One is a verse about the king, another is a verse about the servant, the other is a verse about the conqueror in these different pre-exile, exile, post-exile, these different sections of the book. And I want you to listen as each of these brothers read. Do you hear something repeated that describes all three of them that's similar? Okay? So, Brett, you go first. 11:2. Okay. Just hold what he said. Let's listen now to the next one. This is 42:1. Okay? And now 61:1. Did I ask somebody to do that? Sorry. Yeah, thanks. What do you hear that describes this individual consistently, same way each time? Spirit of the Lord. The trajectory from devastation to joy and fruitfulness and beauty, addressing the problem of blindness and hardness of heart, is going to be both the judgment caused by the Holy One of Israel and the solution brought by the Holy One of Israel. And how's the Holy One of Israel going to do it? Through one man, through an individual filled with his spirit to be what his people could not be. Okay, so now we go a little bit further and say, well, how does this address the devastation that we saw from the beginning to the end? And let me just trace this with you briefly and think about this one. I think you've already seen hints of it with, I know we have in our small group, 1-5, it ends with this vineyard that's fruitless. And then we come to chapter 6. Right? The vineyard's been mowed down in 6. How does 6:13 end at the end of Isaiah's commissioning? The holy seed is its stump. Offspring, singular, right? Now we go a little bit further and say, well, does the book end? It doesn't just end there. There's so much struggle. It's good. Somebody turn to 37:31. 37:31. I'll read it. And the surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. See, of the one, the holy seed is its stump, but what's God going to do with his vineyard? Other roots are going to go into the ground, and other shoots are going to come up. How is God going to do this? Well, if we look in the servant songs, do we not see that this shoot that's going to grow forth, that's 11:1. What does 52 and 53 say, which we'll get to later today or tomorrow? He grew up, him who was going to be despised and rejected, and some of the descriptions start to sound a little bit like the top of the book, the kind of wrath that was being poured out on the people of God to be mowed down. So it's going to be by means of substitution that the wrath of God goes on his suffering servant, who is the shoot, who is the branch. And then one of my favorite verses in the whole book is 61:1-3. All this is so that they may be called oaks of righteousness and the planting of the Lord, that the Lord may be glorified. When I walk out of my house in Tennessee, it's kind of spring-like, and then it'll frost and everything will die. So it's like happy and sad all at the same time, you know, cover the flowers. But what's hitting me, we've been in our house for 6 or 7 years, and I'm like, we didn't plant all these, whatever they are, my wife would know. We planted like a few of them. But fast forward 7 years later, and I'm like, I got to move them now because we can't walk to where we park our car. Because look at all these sprouts that are coming up because of the first one we put in the ground. That first seed, it multiplies. And the book of Isaiah is going to end in chapter 61. Well, it's going to say in 61 toward the end, they're going to grow up like oaks of righteousness. What a glorious picture. So here's what I want to do with the 7 minutes left. You think we could take a stab at a sentence? Just, you know, you guys are preachers. You're great at sentences. What do we want to say? If somebody came to us and said, hey, you were in Cambridge, what's the book of Isaiah about? All this, just the trajectory, the commission statement, the themes, the spirit-driven individual. What would you want to say? Somebody, you know what? Talk to your partner. Let's talk to our partners, and then we'll see if anyone wants to share some. Can you try to include not the whole kitchen sink, but some of the key things? And you'd be like, I think that's a stab that we would take. This is what the book's about. Talk to your partner, and we'll spend a couple minutes, and we'll start to share. All right. Anybody got anything they want to take a stab at? Andrew, go ahead. Take a stab. Say it one more time. God's transforming through his servant King. Good. And by the power. Anything that anybody would offer as a friendly amendment, or is there something you like most about that? You talked about something similar, want to read something similar to that? Surely it's not the only one. It's good stuff. Oh, it's conquering servant King. Say it again. From desolation to true worship. I won't write everybody else's down. I mean, we're getting there, right? Anybody else just want to share? Okay. Right. So you know, I know first time I went through it, I kind of left off the part of through his servant King. You know, just because it's a book about judgment and salvation. Or the righteous God is going to be glorified through desolation and rebuilding of his people, right? But then you're like, oh, wait, I forgot how. I want God's people to know that it's the Holy One doing it through his chosen servant King. So, again, it's just this is an exercise that we do on our own. But let's remember that the goal is payoff in preaching, okay? So, this exercise is so that we're preaching a text in Isaiah, This is in our mind. So, for example, we just did a small group text of chapter 13, which is mostly about what? Judgment. Actually, it's pretty much all about judgment. Where does the book end, though? Worship of who? All flesh. So there will be some from the nations who repent and turn to the God of Israel, who's going to be revealing himself through his judgment as the Holy One. And he's going to be the one by which they find their salvation if they trust in him. However, the message of judgment is a part of the desolation that God is doing to reveal his glory and to save those who would be a part of his remnant, right? So we have that in our mind as we hit hard text. You got a question or thought? See, because I think you're answering your own question. I would agree with you. The reason I would say is because if we leave out the part of top and tail trajectory, we can make it more about God's preserving of his people. Even like our small group looked at chapter 14 right after chapter 13, and she's like, look at this. He's basically telling his people, like, I'm chosen. You're going to be okay while I judge all the nations if you will trust in me. But we can't miss the trajectory of it's his glory as the Holy One who's going to bring the destruction, as well as the entire earth is going to know of his glory, and he's going to call all flesh to himself. So yeah, I think the top and tail pushes back against making it too centered on his chosen ones, even though that's a critical part of the book. So we're doing a dance. I think I might have referenced this yesterday when I talked, but it might have been in my small group. Our church is going through Matthew right now, and we've asked God's people, if they can, to try to memorize the melodic line throughout the whole series. So that no matter what text we're on, it's just, I don't always mention it, but it's the guardrails of what we do. So therefore, if we're studying one of Jesus' miracles, or his ethical teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, or his confrontation of the scribes and Pharisees with authority that they don't have, it's in the framework to say what? Here's how we're saying it. The kingdom of heaven has come down to earth in Jesus, with all authority unto all the nations, for all obedience, fulfilling all the law and prophets. Boom. Right? So where are we in the story, and how is that message reminding us that the song is about the kingdom of heaven, which is how it's introduced to us in the beginning of Matthew? It's back to the song illustration early on. Is it about a girl? Or is she a picture of what the song's really about? And it'll keep us on the narrow way, if you will, of preaching the text with the intent that it's been given. There's huge payoff. And so let me just say a few last things as I close up. It's a tool for faithful preaching that requires you to start way earlier. Way earlier. Oftentimes, it gets adjusted midway through a series. Oh, man, I'm understanding it better now. It's certainly going to be easier in shorter works than it is a big book like Isaiah.